Good evening. More coronavirus deaths reported, a new primary battle, and Biden and the Iraq war. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Rienzo with some of the news for Wednesday, March 4th, 2020. Two more people have died of the new coronavirus in the United States, bringing the toll to 11. The new confirmed cases were reported on Wednesday around the two most populous cities, New York and Los Angeles. The first California death from the virus was announced by health officials as an elderly adult with underlying health conditions. It was the first coronavirus fatality in the United States outside of Washington State, where 10 have died. The California patient was likely exposed on a Princess cruise ship to Mexico from San Francisco. In Washington, D.C., U.S. lawmakers reached bipartisan agreement on an $8.3 billion emergency bill to help fund efforts to contain the virus. The Senate is expected to act quickly, putting funds into the pipeline to fight the virus. President Trump met with air travel executives on Wednesday and responded to questions about the country's readiness to confront the virus outbreak.
It's safe to fly, and large portions of the world are very safe to fly. So we don't want to say anything other than that. And we have closed down certain sections of the world, frankly, and they've sort of automatically closed them also. And if they'll understand that, and they understand it better perhaps than anybody, yes, it's safe.
Absolutely. And are American businesses overreacting if they're cutting down domestic travel and they're telling people not to fly to conferences inside the United States?
A lot of people are doing a lot of domestic business now. I can tell you, they're staying in this country. They feel safe because we have a, if you look at a percentage, we have a very, very small percentage. And a big percentage of what we have is when we brought in the 40 or so people from the ship. We brought them in, we immediately quarantined them, but you're adding that to the numbers that we had, which were very small. Now what we're going to do is, as people get better, because we have, you know, most of these people are getting better. Some are already released. Some are going home. Some are, you know, get a full 100% report. We're going to take them off the list. But we have a very small number of people in this country. We have a big country. The biggest impact we had was when we took the 40-plus people. They're Americans. I mean, I could say don't let them into the country, but these are Americans, and they were literally stranded. And it was very unfair. We brought them back. We immediately quarantined them. But you add that to the numbers. But if you don't add that to the numbers, we're talking about very small numbers in the United States. We've all done a very good job, all of us. And I think the news has been, and the for the most part, the media has really treated us very fairly, which I appreciate. I think it's very important.
When people yes. down
Meanwhile, officials in Los Angeles declared an emergency as more cases have been discovered.
Since we scheduled this announcement, our Department of Public Health has determined that there are additional new cases in Los Angeles County, which our Director of Public Health will detail in a moment. First, I want to inform the public that as the chair of the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors, I have just signed a proclamation declaring the existence of a local emergency.
In the last 48 hours alone, the LA County Department of Public Health has confirmed 6 new cases of the novel coronavirus in our community. To ensure that the county is further prepared, these 2 declarations of emergency will allow us to further draw down resources from both the federal and state levels of government. We need every tool at our disposal to make sure we're ready to support any coronavirus patients who are diagnosed and to prevent any further spread.
And in New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo warned that many more cases should be expected in the state.
The good news is we have a number of tests that have come back, coronavirus tests. The tests for the people in Buffalo came back negative. The test for the people in Oneida came back negative. We tested someone in Suffolk that came back negative. And the husband of the healthcare worker who traveled to Iran came back negative. I actually wagered the other way. So that's the good news. The not so good news is the case in Westchester, which was a 50-year-old attorney who was tested positive. His wife has also tested positive. His 20-year-old son has also tested positive. His daughter has tested positive, and his neighbor who drove him to the hospital also tested positive. The son is 20 years old and attends Yeshiva University. The daughter is 14 years old and is in the SAR school. And the neighbor is not just a neighbor, but actually drove the attorney to the hospital and therefore was in a car with the attorney in that closed environment, and the neighbors tested positive. That then triggers the detective work, where we go back and we try to make as many connections as possible and do as much research and investigation as possible, and then notify people, right? Whenever you find a case, it's about containment and doing the best you can to keep the circle as tight as possible. I think in this case, people are suspect about what they're hearing, because government now is so polarized in so many ways. The environment is so political that you hear different messages about this situation. And then it gets politicized. The Democrats say the Republicans are trying to minimize it. Republicans say the Democrats are hyping it. So I think it's very important here in New York that I provide the factual information to people so they know these are just the facts. There are going to be many, many people who test positive. By definition, the more you test, the more people you will find who test positive. And the people who we are most concerned about, who are most vulnerable, are senior citizens, people with immune compromise, compromised situations. Those are the people who are most vulnerable. But we're worried about nursing home setting, senior care setting. That's what we've seen in places, other places, and that's where the situation is most problematic. The level of health care and the quality of health care is very important. Luckily, here in New York, we have one of the best healthcare systems on the globe, period. And we are doing everything humanly possible to improve even on that.
Healthcare has been an issue in the campaign for president. On the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders' Medicaid for All position is being challenged by Joe Biden's public option proposal. A fellow with the Institute of Health Policy Studies is Jim Kahn. He says the Sanders proposal would be the best way to deal with an outbreak like the coronavirus.
You want people who have symptoms like fever that could be coronavirus to go to the doctor quickly. Right now, with 10% of the population not insured and another big chunk of the insured population underinsured, people delay going to the doctor or the emergency department. So people could be sick with coronavirus and they're not seeking medical attention because of the financial barriers. That's a huge problem. And so under Medicare for All, everyone would be insured. There'd be no cost sharing. And if someone was sick, they would just go to the doctor. The second issue, and apologies for this, it's a little geeky on my part, but right now the information we get from the medical claims processing, in other words, when doctors submit bills with claims to be paid, the information we get is different for every insurer, and it's never put together into a consistent database, and it takes literally years to get. But just imagine what would happen if with a single payer, with a single billing process, everyone would submit, all patients and all visits would lead to exactly the same kind of bill. It would be a single database, and it could be done in such a way that it's available to the public health experts within days to weeks. And that would give them a real leg up in identifying patterns across the country in particular types of diagnoses.
Jim Kahn is a fellow with the Institute of Health Policy Studies. We'll be hearing from him more a little bit later in the cast. Meanwhile, the search for a Democrat to challenge Republican U.S. President Donald Trump in the November 3rd election narrowed on Wednesday to a choice between Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden, who staged a comeback in voting Super Tuesday to become the undisputed standard bearer of the party's moderate wing. Biden was set to win 10 of the 14 states up for grabs on Tuesday, including the major prize of Texas. His strong performance ended Senator Sanders' status as the Democratic front runner and forced former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg out of the race altogether. But last night, as he began his victory speech, a group of protesters demanding an end to the use of dairy products and by extension an improvement in the life of cows had their say as well.
In the neighborhoods we come from, the three...
The fallout from Super Tuesday was quick and coming. Earlier today, Bloomberg gave up his presidential campaign and endorsed Biden after spending hundreds of millions of dollars of his own money on ads across the United States. Bloomberg failed to deliver convincing results on Tuesday, the biggest day of voting in the Democratic nomination campaign, with contests in 14 states across the country.
Now look, today I am clear-eyed about our overriding objective, and that is victory in November. Not victory for me or our campaign, but victory for our country. If you remember, I entered the race for president to defeat Donald Trump. And today, I am leaving the race for the same reason, to defeat Donald Trump, because staying in would make it more difficult to achieve that goal. I've always believed that data should inform our decisions. That's the way I ran my business and foundation. It's the way we ran City Hall. In fact, our campaign slogan was, "In God we trust, everyone else bring data." Well, after yesterday's results, the delegate math had become virtually impossible, and a viable path to the nomination just no longer existed. And I will not be our party's nominee. But I will not walk away from the most important political fight of my life, and I hope you won't walk away either. I've always believed that defeating Donald Trump starts with uniting behind the candidate with the best shot to do it. And after yesterday's vote, it is clear that candidate is my friend and a great American, Joe Biden. I've known Joe for a very long time. I know his decency, his honesty, his commitment to the issues that are so important to our country, including gun safety, health care, climate change, and good jobs. And I've had a chance to work with Joe on those issues over the years, especially when he was vice president. He fought for working people his whole life. And I'm glad to say I endorse Joe Biden, and I hope you will join me in working to make him the next president of the United States of America.
Biden is currently leading the delegate count with 477 to Sanders' 418. Warren so far has 36 delegates. Biden has opened a massive lead in betting odds after Super Tuesday as of Wednesday afternoon, now given more than an 80% chance to be the Democratic nominee to take on President Trump in November. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Senator Bernie Sanders made clear on Wednesday that his focus after Super Tuesday will be trying to draw a sharp contrast between himself and former Vice President Joe Biden in what has shaped up to be a two-person race. Sanders vowed to fight on despite losing his delegate lead to Biden, who swept the South on Tuesday night in an evening that cast serious doubt on whether the Democratic Party wants the revolution Sanders has promised. Sanders had this to say in Vermont earlier today.
Campaign, we were obviously especially gratified to win in Utah, win in Colorado, win in California, the largest state in the country where there are more delegates. And I am always grateful for the support that I receive here in the state of Vermont. Now, I haven't seen the latest delegate count. But my guess is that after California is thrown into the hopper, it's going to be pretty close. We may be up by a few. Biden may be up by a few. But I think we go forward basically neck and neck. And I very much look forward and be on a plane tomorrow going out west and campaigning and doing everything we can to win in Michigan and Washington, Mississippi, North Dakota, Idaho, and Missouri. What this campaign, I think, is increasingly about is which side are you on? Our campaign is unprecedented because there has never been a campaign in recent history that has taken on the entire corporate establishment. And I'm talking about Wall Street, and I'm talking about the insurance companies and the drug companies and the fossil fuel industry. There has been never a campaign in recent history which has taken on the entire political establishment. And that is an establishment which is working frantically to try to defeat us. And there's not been a campaign, I think, that has been having to deal with the kind of venom we're seeing from some in the corporate media. This campaign has been compared to the coronavirus on television. We have been described as the Nazi army marching across France, etc., etc. As we come into the last several months of this campaign, what I hope very much is that what we can focus on is an issue-oriented campaign which deals with the concerns of the American people. As some of you may recall, the last debate that took place really was, I think, insulting to the American people. It was a food fight. It was about who could yell the loudest. That's not what the American people want. They want a serious debate on serious issues. Joe Biden is somebody I have known for many years. I like Joe. I think he's a very decent human being. Joe and I have a very different voting record. Joe and I have a very different vision for the future of this country. And Joe and I are running very different campaigns. And my hope is that in the coming months, we will be able to debate and discuss the very significant differences that we have. Joe is running a campaign which is obviously heavily supported by the corporate establishment. At last count, he has received funding from at least 60 billionaires. 60 billionaires. Our campaign has received more campaign contributions from more Americans, averaging $18.50, than any campaign in the history of our country at this point in time. So what does it mean when you have a campaign which is funded very significantly by the wealthy and the powerful? Does anyone seriously believe that a president backed by the corporate world is going to bring about the changes in this country that working families and the middle class and lower income people desperately need?
And that is candidate Senator Bernie Sanders. On news of Super Tuesday's sweep by Biden, the stock market rallied by over 1,000 points today, but analysts say it's still too early to predict if the markets will recover from the sell-off caused by the sudden shock of the coronavirus outbreak. Health insurance industry stocks led the surge in the wake of Biden's strong showing in the Democratic presidential primary. Insurance stocks opened up 600 points after traders appeared to bet the candidate's resurgence would box out any chance of single-payer universal health care. As reported earlier, Jim Kahn of the Institute of Health Policy has been following the positions of the candidates on health care. He lays out how Sanders' vision would make insurance companies obsolete, while Biden would strengthen them by using the government to insure the poorest.
Bernie Sanders is proposing Medicare for All, also known as single payer. And basically what that means is proposing that a single public agency pay for all health care, which is delivered by both private doctors and hospitals as well as public doctors and hospitals. Everyone is covered, and there's little or no cost sharing. What Joe Biden is proposing is called a public option. So through the system set up by the Affordable Care Act, the health exchanges, you add a publicly sponsored option so that people, instead of just having the choice of buying some private insurance plan, they also have an option that is similar in most ways, or in all ways, but is sponsored by the government.
Why would insurance companies want the Biden plan and not the Bernie plan?
Because it leaves them in place. So they would still retain the vast majority of the market. So relatively few people would buy the public option. Certainly some percent of people would choose it. It might be a little cheaper, at least initially. Through something called risk selection, the private insurers are likely to be able to attract healthier people, which leaves sicker and more expensive people to the public plan. That makes the public plan over time increasingly expensive and therefore increasingly less attractive. And so basically the private insurers would continue to exist under a public option approach. Under Medicare for All, the role of the private insurers at the center of our health system would disappear. There are three major problems with the Biden approach. Number one, you would still have inferior insurance. It's called Medicaid for poor people. And that would continue to exist. It's certainly better than nothing, but it's worse than private insurance. Second problem is you wouldn't insure everyone. Right now, 10% of the U.S. population is uninsured, and you would not solve that problem completely. Third, underinsurance. You would not get rid of the problem of growing deductibles. Right now, about a third of people have very substantial deductibles in the range of $1,000 to $2,000 or more. Those deductibles make it harder to get care and creates financial barriers, and people delay care. And the final thing is, unless you revamp the system in the way that's proposed with Medicare for All, you don't save any money. The way that Medicare for All is affordable is that you get rid of $500 billion in annual paperwork excess. That's how much extra we spend every year to deal with the complexity of our payment system.
A number of people I talk to say to me that they fear that they hear horror stories, which I don't think are true, but they hear horror stories. They're going to be waiting online like they do in Canada, quote unquote, and other big problems that they think are associated with an inefficient medical system.
I think it would be very reasonable to have those kinds of concerns. But when you look at all of the evidence from the other wealthy democracies, so that would be in Europe, in Asia, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, what you find is they're paying about half as much as us typically, and they are providing excellent access to care, better than we are. If this was a hypothetical, I would say to these people, you might be right, but it isn't a hypothetical. We have all of this concrete evidence from several decades of experience, and their systems work really well.
Jim Kahn is a fellow with the Institute for Health Policy. And as a senator from Delaware, Joe Biden was a leader of the Warhawk faction of Democrats who helped President George W. Bush push through the invasion of Iraq. Stephen Zunis is a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco. He says to vote for Biden is to vote for more war.
Not only did Joe Biden vote for the Iraq war, he played a major role in making the war possible. He was head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee at the time, but allowed only a day and a half of hearings, even though this was the most important foreign policy decision of a generation. And he stacked the hearings with pro-war people, wouldn't let the major scholars and State Department veterans and former weapons inspectors who were skeptical, who would have testified Iraq really didn't have all these so-called weapons of mass destruction, that the war was illegal, that the war would be an utter disaster. He didn't want to hear that. He just brought in folks like these sketchy exiles who insisted that they'd seen these stacks of chemical weapons with their own eyes, and of course American soldiers would be welcome as liberators and that sort of thing. Given the importance of the Foreign Relations Committee and the fact that Biden, for all intents and purposes, was the Democrats' chief foreign policy spokesman, Biden was really the person who made it possible for the Democratic-controlled Senate, which could have stopped the war, to instead go ahead and vote for the war authorization. Trump himself, I believe, could be more dangerous than Biden, but Biden does carry a more explicitly pro-interventionist line. Trump, in certain ways, has allied himself with the more kind of libertarian isolationist wing of the Republican Party. He actually ran to Clinton's left in 2016, saying that he opposed the Iraq War, which he actually didn't, but he claimed he did, and put Hillary on the defensive about her outspoken support for it. The counties, which switch most dramatically from the anti-war Obama in 2008 and 2012 to Trump in 2016, they parallel almost exactly the counties with the highest casualty rates from Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, Trump was quite good at trying to present himself before these largely working-class constituencies that they were not going to send their children to die, and it really seemed to have worked. But Biden is the nominee. He is going to be outflanked from the left by Trump, even though, again, I think overall Trump is far more dangerous in his foreign policy.
So what do you think about how he's going to handle, if he gets in, Biden, some of the things like the recognition of Jerusalem and some of these other meeting with Kim Jong-un? Is he going to just reverse all that stuff?
He's certainly not going to reverse the moving the embassy to Jerusalem. In fact, Biden was a co-sponsor of a bill going way back to the 1990s calling on the United States to unilaterally recognize Israel's control of Jerusalem as its capital and to move the embassy there. So he won't be reversing that. He may, ironically, reverse a meeting with Kim Jong-un. He's actually taken a more hawkish view on Korea than has Trump. I mean, I think there are certain areas where he may moderate himself somewhat. I mean, he used to be a big supporter of the Saudi regimes and the other family dictatorships of the Gulf, but there's been increasing pressure for him to take a more critical line on Saudi Arabia, which he has. But I think we'll see a foreign policy that's less impulsive. I think, for example, we might be less likely to get in a war with Iran. Unfortunately, if you're one of these people like I am who thinks human rights and international law ought to be more cornerstone of U.S. policy, there won't be a huge difference between the two candidates.
Stephen Zunis is a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, March 4th, 2020. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.